You're listening to a podcast of spurious morality.
Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston, and with me this week I have Greg.
Hello.
And I have Jimmy.
Hi, good to be back.
We're going into season 15 of classic Doctor Who, and at the end of 14 we sort of said that there's sort of a notable dip in quality at this point, and I don't think classic whoever really comes out of this dip. There are examples, obviously, of excellence throughout the latter part of the 70s and the 80s, but I think that we've been so spoiled by the 70s so far, and particularly sort of 12, 13 and 14, that it feels like a bit of a step down here. But nevertheless, there is some great stuff to be discovered in season 15. So I will start off by asking you both what your favourite story from this run is. So go ahead, Greg, you go first.
You know, this is a tough question for me because I don't think there is an example of a truly great classic episode in this season. Some people would argue Image of the Fendal, but for me, The Sunmakers is my favorite one of this season. We'll talk about it later, but I think the script is wonderful. The ideas are great. It's very witty. It's very refreshing and different, and it's a very interesting story, and I like it a lot.
It's kind of Robert Holmes in angry mode, and yeah, I think it works really, really well. What about you, Jimmy?
I suppose if I were trying to be totally objective, then the obvious choice would be Horror of Fang Rock. But I'm not a totally objective person. I've got to give it to The Invasion of Time. It goes way downhill in the last episode, but for the most part, it's a brilliant, underrated story, I find. And it's one of the first Tom Baker stories I ever saw back in the day from memory. Not sure if it's the first, but certainly one of the first few.
I'm with you, Jimmy. I think The Invasion of Time is absolutely wonderful. It's bonkers. It's Doctor Who, like, struggling across the finish line. Like, we've got to complete this season. How do we do it? Let's just pull together everything we possibly can. And you've got this really, really odd, nothing else quite like it, six-parter that just goes, you know what, forget it. The inside of the TARDIS can just look like an abandoned hospital. That's fine. It's not a problem. Carry on. Tell the story. So, yeah, I've a lot of love for The Invasion of Time. But I can't get through this section without mentioning Image of the Fendal. I am one of those people, I'm afraid, Greg. I love it. I think it's an absolutely fantastic story. I think if I had to pick, it probably is Invasion of Time, but Fendal is an exceptionally close second. This is probably the most I've struggled to single out a favourite since we started doing this, actually. We'll jump straight in. We'll go straight for it. We'll talk about all of those stories and more, obviously. We're going to cover the entire season in this episode. So first one from the run is Horror of Fang Rock, which is very, very sort of Philip Hinchcliffe, actually. It sort of tonally fits in more with the two seasons we've had before this. But it's not. It's a unique story for many, many reasons. It's one of the few where all guest characters die. There aren't many of those in Doctor Who, really. Tom Baker's great in this. Louise Jameson's absolutely brilliant in this. You can sort of tell that there's chemistry there now, that sort of all the disagreements of the past have settled. I think it was this story where something along the lines of Louise Jameson basically turned around to Tom Baker and said, I'm your co-star now, deal with it. and they started to get on from that point. I think it's wonderful. There's some amazing model work. The Rutan's a fantastic villain. And it really does feel sort of cramped and claustrophobic. This is Doctor Who doing sort of horror very competently, very well. Greg, do you want to tell us your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you started with there about how it feels like it's part of the Hinchcliffe era is significant, because this is a story that it's the first of the new producers' era. It's the first Graham Williams story. And like we see later on in season 18, the first, you know, John Nathan Turner story is wildly different from what came before, whereas this is actually just pretty much more of the same. And that's a good thing, because the Hinchcliffe era was so good. Like you said, it is a very claustrophobic story. They actually use the studio-bound nature of it to really good effect. The performances are great. The Rutans are frightening, as you say. One thing I do like about it is that it's not dragged out. Like for a four-part story that is confined almost entirely to one location, like there's a lot of interesting developments that happen. There's a lot of good work with the characters. This is, I believe, the only Doctor Who story in which literally the entire supporting cast, every single character, dies. There are others that come close, but even in, you know, Pyramids of Mars, which is a famous example, we don't know what happens to the Egyptian men that are guiding Scarman to the tomb at the beginning, so they presumably survive. But here, every single person that appears on screen that isn't the Doctor or Leela ends up dead. And it's a bit dark and a bit cynical, especially for a Terence Dix script of this era. But I just think it works really well. I like that, you know, we get this glimpse into the Rutans that isn't tied to the Suntarans at all. Like it's its own thing. It's really a great start to the season. It's not representative of what's coming, but it's great. I love it.
It's quite interesting, really, that it does sort of hang over from the previous era so much. Like the Graham Williams era certainly does have its own identity and really does go off in its own direction. And, you know, by season 16, you know, we're telling stories that you would definitely never have seen during Hinchcliffe's era. I'm thinking like the Pirate Planet, for example. But we do still have these sort of little stabs at horror, these darker stories. You know, we've got Fang Rock, we've got Fendal, we have the Stones of Blood in 16. So that sort of influence of the Hinchcliffe era is still very much there. And I'll talk about it a bit more when we get to Fendal, because I think Fendal is far more Hinchcliffian than Hinchcliffian, that's a new word. But I think it is far more Hinchcliffian than Fang Rock is. But yeah, good story. Jimmy, your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I really like the way that it feels like a sort of hangover from the Hinchcliffe era. I love the whole dark atmosphere and historical setting and low light and such. And I think it's a great story for Leela. I love her character in this. Some of the stuff she says, like when she promises to cut out Palmerdale's heart and the Doctor just doesn't react, or when she's getting sarcastic with them when, oh, that's what I thought, but I'm only a savage, like taking the piss out of the Doctor always calling her that, which is something that I think needed to happen. And, you know, telling Adelaide that it's better to believe in science and being shown to be smarter than the posh upper-class woman. And there's also some funny stuff like Tom's massive grin when he tells them all, oh, we're under attack and could all be dead by morning. The grin practically comes off his face. It's brilliant. And I loved Leela's line where she was surprised about them not trusting space creatures because, oh, we're from space, which is a unique perspective for a companion. And also her confusion when Vince gets all embarrassed because she's changing her clothes in front of him. It's nice when she gets characterised as not just the typical companion, but stuff that actually focuses on, you know, her uniqueness. So, yeah, I really love this story. It's such a great start to this new era, and yeah, very atypical for it, but it's nice to see how well they could handle a story in the style of the previous tenure.
You've got an excellent point about Leela and how this is a very, very good story for her. You know, she gets some really good, strong moments that she doesn't necessarily in other places. And part of me kind of thinks, you know, if Leela was written like this all the time, would we have got another season out of Louise Jameson? Would we have had that? Well, I say third Leela season, it's more of 2.5 Leela season. But yeah, it would be great to have more of the character. And, you know, they were obviously hoping until the very, very last minute that she'd hang on and do a little more, which again, we'll pick up on when we get to Invasion of Time. But yeah, really, really good story for Leela, this. Probably the best so far, although I do really like her in Robots of Death. But yeah, it's, as you both said, really strong start to the season, but not quite a sign of what is yet to come. However, I think the next story, the story we're moving on to now, The Invisible Enemy, is a bit more of an indicator of what is to come. It's not my favourite. It's never going to be. I don't dislike it. It's a very entertaining four parts, but it's all of a sudden things feel a bit, I don't know, a bit shoddier, a little bit more amateur. Doesn't quite feel as a tighter production as what's come before. And that's, again, something we're going to see a bit of throughout the next few series. This seems to be the first one where things just aren't so great. You know, you've got the pre-cut bit of stone that comes out the wall when K-9 blasts it. And the inside of the Doctor's mind looks absolutely terrible. It's some of the worst set design ever on Doctor Who. I'm glad I've got this negativity out the way first. It does many great things. You know, it is another good story for Leela. Introduces K-9 and is a really good use of K-9. The Swarm is quite an interesting concept. We've got some great characters in there, great performances. But yeah, ultimately, it just doesn't quite hold together in the way that it perhaps could do. So Greg, go for it, The Invisible Enemy.
I think what sets this one apart and what makes it more distinctly Williamsian, I guess, that's another word we can invent, is that it's set so explicitly in quote unquote space and in the future. Like in, you know, season 13 and 14, like we do have episodes that are on alien planets, you know, like Planet of Evil, for example, but that is so dark and scary. I mean, the focus that's really, you know, on how scary this planet is, not, oh, we're on an alien planet. And, you know, I mean, yeah, Brain of Morbius is set on Karn, but it might as well be set on a mad scientist's lab on Earth. You know, there's no, it doesn't look any different, really. You know, say again, and then, you know, Face of Evil. I mean, apart from the scenes inside the Tesh's compound, you know, that's another one that could practically be set on Earth. But, you know, The Invisible Enemy is not that. I mean, everything here is, you know, futuristic, quote unquote, for their budget. Stark, you know, brightly lit hallways and research laboratories. Like when they go into the Doctor's mind, it's weird looking, but it is not dark. It's, you know, lots of like bright effects and so on going on. The only thing I think that connects it back to the Hinchcliffe era is the nucleus of the Swarm, which is still a cackling, you know, insane villain character, which you see less and less of as this era goes on. Is it a good story? Not really. I mean, all this effort to make it look futuristic does not come off. It generally looks terrible. Yes, like you said, we do get the introduction of K-9, like the professor is a good character, but it just feels like, oh, we're just going to do Fantastic Voyage, basically. And I admire the ambition, but you've got to be able to look at what your capabilities are and say, maybe we should think of something else. So yeah, it's not my favorite, but I didn't find it, you know, offensive to my sensibilities or anything like that. It was just kind of a dull, mediocre story, but that's okay.
I also think that we've just had a run of non-stop excellent story. I mean, when was the last time doing this we said, not sure about this one? Was it Planet of Evil? Was it, you know, two seasons ago? We've had such a good run of stories. And when you're watching through Doctor Who in order, this feels like someone has really slammed on the brakes after the momentum that you've had with everything that's come for the past couple of seasons. So maybe that's why sort of I'm not the biggest fan of this one, because when you compare what came before, it's really not up to the same standard. Jimmy, go ahead.
For this one, I kind of like the story, but it's definitely nothing spectacular or brilliant or whatever. It's just good, solid, decent, nothing particularly amazing in any way about it. So the thing that sort of really got to me was the bits that sort of were really silly or didn't make sense. Like, the two of the most prominent ones are the weird spellings of everything. Like, I get they were trying to make it look all futuristic, the language has evolved, but it just looked weird and stupid, let's be honest. And then there's the odd thing of the nucleus, when they're in the Doctor's head, it looks completely different to when it gets enlarged and is in the real, well, the outside world. It's like, why has it changed? What's, like, it didn't make much sense. And the other thing is the sort of inconsistencies about the clone of the Doctor and Leela when they jump into his head. There's bits where it's like they're connected somehow to the real things, even though they should be a clone and separate. Like, there's this bit where where Leela kicks something in the Doctor's head and the clone Doctor reacts as if something had happened in his head. Or the bit where the cloned Leela feels a bump on her head when the real Leela's knocked out. And I'm like, that makes absolutely no sense. Like, if they're clones, the stuff that's happening to the real things shouldn't be affecting them. And so it just really bugged me for some reason. I just thought, like, make it make sense.
I think one other thing that really gets me about this one is, going back to something Greg said, actually, is it's a bit overambitious. Like, they do not manage to visually represent what the script requires. Now, this is Bob Baker and Dave Martin, who have been around since The Claws of Axos now, and near enough everything they've contributed is too big, is too ambitious. They don't manage to pull it off. Like, it just feels like maybe by this point they should probably have more of an idea of what can and can't be achieved by a Doctor Who production team in the 70s. But
I'm sure that won't come up again this season.
No, absolutely not. No, from now on, everybody sort of knows what they're doing within the budget. but yeah, you just sort of think, you know what? They could probably have redrafted this one and knocked a bit of money off why couldn't the Doctor's brain be represented by TARDIS corridors? Oh no, we haven't got any TARDIS corridor sets. That's something we're going to come to later. I don't know. Anyway, let's move on. Let's get ourselves on to the next story, which is, of course, Image of the Fendal. This is even more of a Philip Hinchcliffe story, I think. This is old Priory's mad scientists, evils from the dawn of time, gothic terror, pentagram, all that kind of thing. It's absolutely great. And I think the Fendal is such a fantastic concept, a fantastic villain. We're in an era now where Russell T. Davies is kind of mucking about in godlike Doctor Who villain territory. We've had, obviously, the Toymaker, and we've had Sutek, and we've created a new character in the Maestro that's like this. I think Fendal falls into the same category. A really, really wonderful concept. I'm surprised that Fendal hasn't been used again on screen, more in Big Finish. We've had a few Big Finish stories, but they're sort of fairly few and far between. If I remember correctly, it is just the one in Further Adventures of Lucy Miller and a Torchwood story, both of which are very good, very interesting takes on the Fendal. But yeah, I think there's definitely room for more to happen around this one. But what we do get is absolutely great. It's really atmospheric, maybe not as atmospheric as, you know, some of the Hinchcliffe horror-y stuff, or even Horror of Fang Rock, which certainly has an atmosphere. But I really like some of the concepts going on here, that sort of science meets the supernatural, a bit Quatermass-like. It's a very, very strong story, and one that I do like to revisit quite often. Greg, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, we talked about how, or you talked about, I should say, how, you know, Bob Baker and Dave Martin always seemed too overambitious for Doctor Who. Well, this is a Chris Boucher story, and he, on the other hand, seems perfectly suited to Doctor Who. This is his third, and I believe final script for the show, and all three are home runs, and this is no exception. It's incredibly gothic horror-y. Like, it's maybe a more, you know, quote-unquote Hinchcliffean story than anything we actually got in the Hinchcliffe era. I mean, it's almost a parody. It's so like exactly what you would expect from that era. And yet here it is just kind of floating strangely in the middle of this other season. I like the comparison you draw to, you know, what Russell Davis has been doing with the new Doctor Who season, because this story really does not engage very much with scientific explanations. Like, the Doctor throws a few things around, but ultimately, you know, why does salt wound the Fendaline? Because they're, you know, evil demons, and salt repels evil demons. That's honestly, you know, what's going on here. And, you know, that's kind of the same logic that, you know, the most recent season operated on in several episodes. I don't know, there's dispute over, you know, how welcome that is in Doctor Who, but I like it. I mean, I think it really works here, because I like the suggestion that there's danger in the universe that, like, is beyond the Doctor's explanation. I mean, the way this is filmed, like, the actual skull of the Fendal, it's just a prop, and it just sits there, but the way that it glows, and the sound design, which is so good, it makes it absolutely terrifying. You know, and even the Fendaline, I mean, they're well-designed monsters, but they, you know, just, if you just put one in a room, it would look ridiculous. But the way they're shot, like, a lot of canted angles, a lot of crash zooms, again, like, a lot of really disturbing sound design, like, it really makes it feel scary. Like, this is a well executed bit of Doctor Who. You know, I personally prefer the next one a bit more, but honestly, I mean, if Sunmakers is my number one, this is my number 1A, because this is really good. This was a lot of fun to watch.
It is a real shame, I think, that after this, Chris Boucher kind of moved over to Blake 7 and did an absolutely fantastic job on that, the script editor and essentially the role that we would now call showrunner towards the end. But I do feel as though we were potentially robbed of some more fantastic Doctor Who from him. And by the time he'd finished with Blake 7 and, you know, realistically could have returned to Doctor Who, John Nathan Turner had kind of imposed the no old writers rule. And I know that got broken once or twice later on. But if anybody should have written more classic Who, it's definitely Chris Boucher. I think, as you say, Chris Boucher really, really understood the show, understood what would and wouldn't work on a budget, and created some amazing concepts. I mean, these two stories from the previous season both created really interesting and imaginative societies, and this one sort of does something similar, but there's more of a focus on the villain here, and I think it works particularly effectively. Jimmy, what do you think of Image of the Fendal?
Well, for me, I've got to disagree. I really don't like this one that much. There's a few great moments and stuff that I do like about it, but for the most part, the whole more fantastic, fantasy, horror sort of side of things, when they go too far in that direction, it doesn't work for me. I mean, there's exceptions like I love The Curse of Fenric, and I love what they did with the Toymaker in the new series, but for the most part, when they do this, it just doesn't work for me. Like, back in season 8, the demons, and this is a lot closer to that. It's better than the demons, but it's definitely not a favourite. I mean, the whole fantasy, horror, magic sort of thing just sort of doesn't work for me if there's not at least some tiny hint of a scientific explanation. Like, if there's some, even if it's, oh, I don't understand it, but it's scientific, it's not so bad. But when it's all just, no, this is real magic, it sort of bothers me. There's also another thing I didn't like in this one is there's this weird bit where Leela kisses one of the scientist idiots, and it just feels very random and out of character. Like, I guess they were trying to sort of set up, oh, she could fall in love with someone and leave for the invasion of time, but it just felt really completely out of character. Also on Leela, I really don't like the new costume. It just looks a bit silly and not very practical. I mean, the other one looks a bit more sort of not very well covering, but it at least looks like armour, whereas this just looks like rags, and it just doesn't work for me. I do like some things about this story. Like, I love the bit where Leela is very good and understanding and patient with the traumatised Gren. It's nice to see that side. Like, she's not just a brutal warrior or whatever. She also understands how people can be traumatised, and, you know, she can show compassion and be understanding. And I thought that was brilliant. And another thing that I liked was the bit where the Doctor offers the skull a jelly baby, and that sort of lighter moment in an otherwise very dark story. And the other thing that I thought was a bit interesting was at the start, there's this bit about the Doctor and Leela discussing the TARDIS and canines pronouns, which feels like a description of something that would happen in this new era. But this bit about calling the TARDIS she, but the Doctor being reluctant to call canine he and calling him it, I just thought it was really interesting, and like, it would be handled so different these days that they'd make a big thing of it. But here it was just, you know, a sort of throwaway scene. Another one I would have to mention is the bit where the Fendal costume, when it possesses the woman, most of the costume's very good, but the eyes look really crap, the painted on eyes. And it makes me wonder if that line about don't look at the eyes, it's sort of a bit like the Weeping Angels in the new series where they give you this don't look thing and try to make the audience not look. And I'm wondering if they had don't look at the eyes because it's good advice because it's the one part of the costume that doesn't work. there was also, where is it in my notes? Oh, yes, the one other thing is the bit in the cellar when the ritual's been done where the Doctor, you know, helps the guy to kill himself off screen. That was really dark and messed up. I mean, on the one hand, it's a really powerful moment, but on the other hand, it just feels very out of character and like it was handled a bit too lightly almost. So, yeah, that's why it doesn't work for me, but it's not completely terrible or anything. It's just, yeah, not the sort of story that I'd pick to watch off the top of my head, really. It's, yeah, a bit out there.
I suppose we've been comparing it an awful lot to stuff from Hinchcliffe's era, but Hinchcliffe's era always had some kind of fairly solid bedding in science. You know, Sutek's not a god, he's an Asiren. He's a very, very advanced alien race from earlier on in the universe and all that kind of thing. Whereas there are bits and bobs here and there's a similar kind of explanation, but yeah, you're right. It's certainly not as sort of solidly explained. And it's actually an interesting comparison with the demons. I've never kind of considered that before, but you're right. They're actually quite similar stories. I definitely pick Fendal as my favourite of the two, though. And I do like the demons, but yeah, Fendal's excellent. I really enjoy it. So we're moving on to Greg's favourite now, the Sunmakers, which this is Robert Holmes grumpy because his tax bill's been a bit too high. The taxman's come after him, and Robert Holmes sort of channeling that level of grumpiness into a script. I think it works exceptionally well. Some nice location work in this one, some interesting characters, and some really sort of bonkers concepts. You know, we get Doctor Who does capitalism quite a lot now, but it was fairly rare at the time. And I think that it's certainly a nice change. It's a nice change of pace. It's certainly unlike anything else in the same season. In fact, I'd argue it's unlike any other Doctor Who story. It's fairly unique. It's one with a lot to enjoy. It suffers for me for similar reasons to Invisible Enemy, in which I just don't think it's up to the standard of a lot of what has come relatively immediately before it. But I still do really enjoy it. There's some great sequences in there, and we're really starting to get the humorous side of Tom's Doctor through now as well. He's becoming a less serious character, and we're not quite into script edited by Douglas Adams silly territory yet, but we're definitely getting that more lighthearted, that more amusing Doctor through some excellent jokes about the Taxman and so on. So, Greg, tell us what's your favourite and other things about it.
What I think makes the story stand out right off the bat is that it doesn't have a villain in the same way that so many previous stories, especially in the Hinchcliffe era, had. I mean, yes, there are bad guys, but ultimately the villain of the story just is, you know, is the company, is the government. Like, it, you know, the collector is just sort of a functionary in a way. I mean, you know, the collector's not this crazed mastermind who's controlling everything. It's just an individual pushing buttons and trying to, you know, follow rules and so forth. And we see a lot more of this as the Williams era goes on, where stories aren't just focused on one villain, like one enemy that the Doctor can stand up and confront. And this is an extreme example of that, but it's one of the best examples of that. I mean, obviously, Robert Holmes is, you know, going after tax services, basically. Supposedly, he was told to keep the politics out of it. So this is him trying to tone down the politics. So I would love to see what would happen if he was unrestrained. And I mean, yeah, I know there was a lot of frustration with this at the time in the UK. I mean, I'm not super familiar with it, but, you know, I understand where this comes from. And I just like how it's such an aggressively satirical story. Like, that's also something we really don't see much of in Doctor Who, where, like, everything has, like, pretty clear real-world antecedents. The problems the characters are having are, you know, linked to problems ordinary people have. It's very, you know, the difficulties of interacting with the company are, you know, very similar to some difficulties people may have interacting with the government, with tax collectors and so forth. And not only is it a smart satire, it's also very funny. There's a lot of great lines in here. There's a lot of, you know, looks from Tom Baker at the camera. I mean, but it's not in that, you're just saying, that silly mode. Like, it's very witty. It's very intelligent. It's hard to describe, really, because, you know, unlike other stories, you know, I can't really go into the, you know, the complex plot or, you know, or the great performance or whatever. It's just, the script is just so good and just links everything together so well. Like, it really, when I was watching through the season, it really made me sit up and take notice, because there are very few Doctor Who stories that are like this. And I mean, there's none that are exactly like this. And it's kind of its own unique thing. It's a lot of fun to watch. To me, it absolutely flies by. Yeah, I mean, it's my favorite of the season, and I, you know, when I came into it, I didn't expect to say that, but it's great.
Yeah, there's definitely an awful lot to enjoy in there, and I think you're right. There's no one specific sort of amazing standout thing about it. It's just a very, very good script, a witty script that, you know, it's well put together. It does look good. It looks incredibly good compared to, well, the invisible enemy that we've already had, and we're going to talk about how stories look quite a lot over the next sort of 20 minutes, half an hour, I imagine. But yeah, it's a nice, solid story.
I guess the only thing I would say, the only thing that I do question about it is, you know, Doctor Who is supposed to be appealing to younger viewers as well. And I can imagine an 8-year-old watching this and being like, what the hell is this? So, you know, but other than that.
Yes. What's tax? That kind of thing. Absolutely. Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, I really like this story. I think it's a bit of an underrated gem. And even the stuff that feels like it shouldn't work sort of does with this. Like, the fact that all the sort of corridors and hallways and most of the setting looks so bland, and yet the Gavra's costume, for example, is very over the top. Like, it makes sense that you've got this ultra-rich company gouging the planet. Of course they're going to make shitty, badly realised corridors they're not going to put any effort in. And, of course, the rich higher-ups are going to be somewhat extravagant. And so the stuff that feels like it shouldn't work there really does. And the Gavra's performance is very over the top, but, I mean, it sort of fits. And the handling of the tax being the monster sort of thing is really done well. Like, some of the lines, like the bit about taxes being more painful than sacrifices to tribal gods, or I really love in particular Leela's line about the people should rise up and slaughter their oppressors, which, Nuhu would never get quite that blunt in its political moments. But there's also some nice sweet bits. Like, I like the bit where most of the rebels won't go with Leela, but Cordo does. And even though he's been very nervous and awkward and not very brave, he steps up and Leela gets that lovely line about him being braver than all the other rebels. And that was a really good bit. But then there's also some weird things. Like, at the start, another thing I couldn't imagine them doing these days, the attempted suicide at the start is, like, that's really dark stuff. Like, I can't imagine it being handled at all on the new series, let alone quite so lightly. And then there's also another odd moment where the company has records on the Time Lords, and it's like, oh yeah, they wouldn't be, they'd be hard to sell to. And it was just really weird. Like, I could buy them knowing the Doctor from history or whatever, but they've heard of the Time Lords and they know what they're like as a buyer. It just, yeah, that was really weird. And other than that, though, it was, yeah, I love the story. It's really great. The one thing that I noticed that was really poorly executed was there's this one scene where K-9 shoots down two of the guards, and the first one, yeah, fine, he sees guard, aim, shoot. But the second guard just walks up slowly and casually and just seems like he's purposely getting into range for K-9 to hit him, and it just looked so stupid. Like, they really needed to do another take of that, because it was, yeah, the silliest moment of the story, I think.
And I think we are now entering an era of comedy canine kills. There do seem to be quite a bit. And also, at this point, we do have a debate of, like, is K-9 killing these people, or is he just zapping them out for a little bit? So I think there's a line later on, or there's something about K-9 Mark II where he has the stun setting. I'm not entirely sure villains are being stunned by K-9 here. It's an interesting one. It's interesting. It's interesting to see K-9 incorporated into this one as well. We didn't mention it in any Image of the Fendal, but obviously he joins at the end of Invisible Enemy, and then Image of the Fendal, he's out of action. Like, oh no, he's broken. We've just got him and he's broken down. And then this is kind of his first, I don't know, companion story. And he gets left in the TARDIS and shoots a few people. It's not a bad story for K-9, by some of the standards that we're going to have moving forward.
I think the bit that you just said there about not knowing if he's killing people, I was watching Invasion of Time a couple nights ago, and my wife was kind of half paying attention to it. And there's a point at which K-9 comes out of the TARDIS and, you know, shoots a Chancellery guard or two. And she's like, Jesus, did he just murder those people? And, you know, like, I think he stunned them, but I don't know.
I hope K-9 Mark I has a stun setting, but I really don't think any stun settings are specifically mentioned until we get to part two. To Mark II, sorry. So, that's an interesting one to just float out there. Is K-9 murdering people all season? We'll move on to Underworld, which isn't going to top anybody's favourite list. And to be perfectly honest, I can't really defend it. Normally, I like to step in at this point and go, everyone thinks this is terrible, but however, it does have these redeeming features. Underworld has part one. Underworld part one, I think, is excellent. I think it looks really good. It's really interesting. We get a nice bit of Time Lord mythology, some really interesting characters and ideas. And then the money runs out and the final three episodes are just a CSO nightmare. Completely just, it's a failure. Like, it's not a good production. It's not done well. It looks terrible. There is no saving this. And I think it's just a shame that that first episode with all that potential is just immediately squandered the moment they step off the spaceship and into the dreadful CSO caves. So, Greg, do you want to talk about Underworld first?
Yeah, I mean, that's really it. This is a fantastic idea for a story and a fantastic involvement of Time Lord and Gallifreyan mythology, and the set design on the ship set, you know, the R1C is excellent. Like, that first episode looks good. It's really interesting. But hang on a minute. We're talking about a story that has a fantastic central idea that is completely impossible to carry off with a Doctor Who. Oh, it's Bob Baker and Dave Martin again. Who would have
Oh, you
guessed?
Surprise me.
Yeah, so again, like, it's, you know, like, the concepts are almost insane. Like, oh, there's a planet, but it's not really a planet. It's just a ship that in a nebula that had a bunch of rocks just accrete around it. And basically it's a ship inside of an asteroid. And it's like, oh, that's a great, cool sci-fi idea. But how on earth is a 1978 BBC TV show going to be able to do that? And the answer is it's not. And it looks terrible. And look, I admire them for at least thinking, you know what, we're not going to be able to build all these sets. We're not going to be able to do all this location filming. We're going to use this CSO technology, and we're just going to, you know, use painted backgrounds or photographed backgrounds, and we're going to do the whole story that way. And, you know, it's like, you know, Marvel using the volume filming thing nowadays, except much, much, much worse. It just doesn't work. Like, it just comes off as exactly what it is. Like, actors standing in front of blue screens or green screens or whatever, just saying weird sci-fi lines at each other. Like, it's Doctor Who in the classic series very rarely looks great, but at least, you know, you can see what they're going for. You can admire their ambition. Like, episodes 2 through 4 of Underworld just come across as amateurish. Like, this should not have been made. It should not have been put on television looking the way it does. I know they didn't have any choice, of course, but, like, this was a terrible idea from the beginning. And unfortunately, despite the fact that the concept of the story is so good, the final three episodes are just running around in caves, except they're not in caves. They're just in a studio in front of a blue screen. So, the actors look bored and confused. It's not good. I mean, it's hard to measure these things, but this has to be the worst Tom Baker story, and it's one of the worst classic stories, just period. And one of the worst Doctor Who stories, period. It's not good.
It is such a shame it squanders that first part. And I've always suggested that this one, if Big Finish made this, if this was an audio drama, and if the script did go through, you know, another draft or two, it could be great. It could be a really, really good, engaging, interesting Fourth Doctor adventure for Big Finish. But it's not. This is actual Fourth Doctor on actual telly in the actual 70s, and just, they were never going to make it work. They should have looked at the scripts and just gone, you know what, we can't do it. Of all the Bob and Dave scripts that should never have been made, this is the one. And that's really saying something, actually. Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, definitely the first episode is a lot better than the rest of it. But I do think it's mostly terrible, but there are a couple of great moments that I will mention later so I can at least end on a positive. But let's start with the bad stuff, because there's so much of it. The first thing is one of the worst bits of characterization for the Doctor and Leela is this bit at the start where the Doctor refers to Leela as semi-intelligent, and I mean, even if it had been one of her first few stories, that would have felt a bit harsh. But here at this point, it's her second to last story. She's been with him for ages. She's proved how competent she is, and she might not have that sort of intellectual bookish knowledge, but she is clearly a smart person, and she clearly knows what's going on. And it just feels ridiculously out of character and ridiculously harsh for the Doctor to call her semi-intelligent at this point. I absolutely hated that moment. And there's also this bit where Canine's helping the ship and the Doctor tells him to stop, and then, you know, they put their weapons to the Doctor and won't let him stop. But Canine is like, oh, I don't understand. I need clarification. And again, Canine being too stupid to understand what the word stop means, that's a huge stretch and some terrible writing. But also, they do have some good writing in this, like the bit about the whole, oh, the time ships of the gods, and each of us has regenerated 1,000 times, and some of the lore stuff there is particularly interesting. And yet it's also really weird that when the crew member in the first episode regenerates, it's just going from old age makeup to not having it. And it's like they're tying this heavily to Gallifrey, so why is the regeneration not an actual regeneration? Why doesn't it change into a different actress? It just feels really poorly thought out, that bit. But to get to those two positives, the first one, and easily my favourite moment of the story, is that bit where Leela gets hit by the pacification ray and she just becomes all sort of placid. But when the Doctor revives her, even though the dialogue is just pure anger and rage, like, the way Louise Jameson acts it is brilliant. Like, Leela is clearly distressed, and Leela doesn't get distressed easily. Like, she's clearly not just embarrassed or worried about losing her who she was, but she's like, she's clearly, you know, she's had her personality taken from her. She's not been in control of herself. And the way Louise plays it is just incredible. It's some brilliant acting, and it's, if we're in a much better story, I think it would be a much more popular moment. But yeah, Louise James knocks it out of the park with that scene. It is some incredible moment. And the other one I liked is at the end of the story, they have the Doctor's really pretentious and nonsensical line about, oh, maybe myths are just prophecies, and he's going on about all this, and then he asks Canine, and Canine just bluntly goes, negative. I loved that. I loved that they undercut that moment, because if they'd let the Doctor just have that sort of pretentious moment and ended, it would have been a really terrible ending. But Canine just being so blunt about, yeah, nah, that's nonsense, mate. I loved that. But yeah, those two moments are great, but the rest of the story, not so much.
I have to admit, I do love the bookending TARDIS scenes in this one. Like, we seem to be in an era now where, having not had the TARDIS at all for a couple of years, every story seems to have that scene at the beginning and that scene at the end, like bookending the story in the TARDIS. And some of them, it's very clear writers were just struggling to come up with something and threw any old nonsense at it. Others, you've got the, you know, which box is larger stuff from Robots of Death, that kind of thing. I quite like this one. The Doctor's doing a bit of painting and Leela and K-9 are just doing, you know, it works quite nicely. It's sort of a rather charming couple of scenes. And like you say, that K-9 sort of with the dry humour at the end, I think, yeah, it does. It works really well. It's a shame Underworld doesn't work. It's full of great ideas and concepts. And unfortunately, it does fall down in the execution. I suppose it's another computer's gone a bit insane story, and we've had a few of those recently, and we've had them done far better. You know, both the Face of Evil and the Green Death have done megalomaniacal computers, and this is just, it is a weaker version of that, and it's kind of a shame that that's what it boils down to, after such a strong and interesting and engaging first part. And even the effects in the first part look good. Even the asteroids falling around the ship looks good. Just everything after that part one reprise at the start of part two just seems to go downhill and keeps going downhill. The money has run out. There's very little they can do about it. and we've still got a six-parter left, and Invasion of Time, I love it. I really do. It's one of my favourite stories ever. I think it's just full of wonderful ideas. I think Tom Baker as an evil doctor, or pretending to be at the very least, is just fantastic. The way he kind of gets himself to the top of Time Lord Society and just bullies everybody around him. It works so well. There are so many great moments in it, and the Vardens, poorly executed on screen. We're getting a theme here, aren't we? Vardens are actually a really good concept, and you know, Big Finish have used them very, very effectively on quite a number of occasions. You know, they've popped up in Companion Chronicles, they've popped up in Third Doctor Adventures. The Fourth Doctor's met them again in Wave of Destruction. It's a great story. And yeah, it really, really strong concept. I'd also say that Invasion of Time has one of the greatest cliffhangers in the show's history. You know, part four, everything's wrapped up, the villains are defeated, the Doctor's even given a big speech about how everything's great now, and then he turns around and there are a load of Sontarans, and it's just like, wow, what a way to just pivot the story in a moment and add an entire new context to everything that's happened so far. And yeah, I really, really love that bit. I love the wandering around in the TARDIS. It doesn't look good, but I really like the idea of when Gallifrey is invaded, when the Doctor's home planet and seat of the Time Lords is invaded, we can still go and hide in the TARDIS, and there's a whole other world in there. And I like the concept of it all being a bit psychedelic. You know, the further into the TARDIS you get, the stranger it is, and it makes sense that some of it looks like a machine, and we finally get to see the TARDIS swimming pool, and I even like the idea of it having an art gallery that's actually a power station. But again, the money's run out and it just doesn't look as good as it should. If we could have had the TARDIS that we see in Castrovalva here, it would be absolutely wonderful. It would be amazing. As a story, it goes on a little bit, but the fact that it does switch up with the Sontarans at the end of part four just kind of manages to even things out a bit. It manages to make it feel like it doesn't drag too much. In some ways, you can kind of look at this as two three-parters that are interconnected. You've got two parts of the Doctor kind of seizing power on Gallifrey. You've got two parts of Vardens, and then you've got two parts of Sontarans. And I really like that as a way of doing a six-parter. I actually think that works well as a format. You know, we've had a lot of six-parters that are maybe four-parters and two-parters or that kind of thing, you know, with Seeds of Doom perhaps being the obvious example. It's essentially two stories that are linked. But I think this is probably the one that breaks the story down the best to work over six episodes. So Invasion of Time, Greg, go ahead.
One of the best features of the story is how it fleshes out Gallifrey. I think a problem that a lot of Doctor Who six-parters run into is, you know, we're always following the plot. And I mean, to have a plot to carry you through 2.5 hours is asking a lot. And, you know, this story, there is a strong plot to it, but a lot of it is spent just exploring things we haven't really seen before. Like, we get to see more of the ceremonial procedures on Gallifrey. We get more of the lore and the history about Rassilon. We get to see what it looks like outside of the Citadel on Gallifrey. We get to see former Time Lords that are living in exile on the surface of the planet. Like, that's completely new and very surprising. It's got a great performance by Tom Baker at the beginning, pretending to be this unhinged Time Lord who's, you know, lost control and wants to conquer his planet. He's almost being the master at this point. And I think it works because what you find out, it's a performance. Like, he's acting that way to convince the Vardens that he's on their side. And so the scene when he can finally relax and talk to Barusa in the lead-lined room, like, like the performance that Tom gives there is great, because you can just see all of that energy like go out of him, and okay, now we can actually talk. I agree that the episode 4 cliffhanger is one of the best in the history of the show. I do think that the story falls down a bit after that point, because once the Centaurans show up at that point, it just basically becomes like chase scenes with Centaurans up and down various corridors. And yes, a lot of those corridors are interesting new things we haven't seen before in the TARDIS. And, you know, and some of that's neat, like, you know, the power room disguised as an art gallery is a cool idea, but a lot of it's just in, you know, empty, like, factory floors, and they keep using the same room to represent different rooms. And I know that's the point, but it's just kind of tedious, and it doesn't work very well for me in those last two parts. But that is not to say that it ruins the story. There's a lot going on here, and there's a lot to see here. But you know, unfortunately, the worst part about it is the ending, where Leela has apparently fallen in love with Andrid and just is leaving, and then K-9 stays with her. And like, it just doesn't work on so many levels, because, I mean, yeah, you get a little bit of that bickering with Leela and Andrid in episode 1, and I guess if you really squint, there's a little romantic tension there, but that's about all you see. And I don't know, it doesn't really make sense. It doesn't really feel true to Leela's character. It feels incredibly abrupt. The doctor doesn't really seem to care that she's leaving. He's just like, oh, all right. You know, he looks a little uncomfortable, but then he just leaves. And it's like, oh, K-9 left, but the doctor's got another one. So what difference does that make? I mean, obviously that gave us lots of cool, you know, big finish stories with K-9 on Gallifrey, but that obviously wasn't what they were thinking of in 1978. So, you know, it really falls apart. But that's not to take away from a story that gives us a lot of interesting background on the Time Lords and on Gallifrey, and has a really fun and interesting plot for those first 4 episodes about, you know, a covert operation to conquer the Citadel of the Time Lords. So, yeah, it's good on balance. I enjoy it. I wish the ending had been stronger.
I've always found sort of Leela's exit and the sort of dislike that it attracts to be somewhat strange. Like, yeah, it's not well done. Let's not pretend for a minute that this is anywhere near the top 50% of companion exit. And we have had some bad companion exits. We have had some dodgy pre-filmed bye-bye Doctor sequences or just clear off halfway through an episode. But this is bad. However, I do like the logic of sort of maybe Leela following her instincts here. You know, Leela is a very instinctive character, and if she's sort of picked up that Andrid is the kind of person she'd... I don't know. I'm squinting to try and justify it, but I think this works with Leela more than it would any other companion. It's not a good exit, but at the same time, if you're going to do this kind of exit, Leela is the character to do it for, because it in some way fits with her characterization, I guess. I've always wondered what the Doctor was thinking, having a second K-9 ready to go already. Like, were we going to have Mark 1 and Mark 2 together? Was that the Doctor's plan, to have two K-9s knocking about in the TARDIS before one decided to leave? Or I don't know. Was he going to decommission Mark 1 and have Mark 2 instead? Obviously, the Gallifrey series, it picks up at the very start, and both Leela and Romana have a K-9 each. And there's some really good interaction between K-9s, Mark 1 and Mark 2, and all that kind of thing. And the spoiler alert, although we've talked about it on this podcast before, K-9 Mark 1 actually gets destroyed on Gallifrey. Like, the Gallifrey series kills K-9. So it's not a great ending, and I'm really glad that we do get Leela and K-9 on Gallifrey for the Gallifrey series, but that was made 30 years later. There's absolutely no reason that Leela's exit should be this iffy, really. But Jimmy, of course, you agreed with me that this is the highlight of the season. So talk us through it. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff to talk about. I'll just start where you finished with Leela's exit, though. I think that was handled rather badly because there was a perfect opportunity there. If they had to have her stay on Gallifrey, why wouldn't she be staying with the outsiders who she's had this camaraderie with? She's helped them in their society already. She's proven herself to them. It just seemed silly to be like, oh, well, she fell in love with Andred. And obviously at the time they couldn't do it this way, but I mean, if you look at the characters she interacts with, she's got more chemistry with Rodan, let's be honest. But yeah, other than that bad exit, I really love this story. I think she's, there's some amazing stuff for both Leela and the Doctor. I mean, particularly Tom playing evil is just absolutely brilliant. He really sells it so well. And Leela, at the same time, her absolute faith in the Doctor, like, she knows that he's not going to be betraying them all, and she even has that lovely line about reason dictates that the Doctor's betrayed us. Well, reason's a liar. It's just such a good Leela line, and she's got a lot of those in that story. I mean, she's also got that line about discussion is for the wise or the helpless, and I'm neither. And she's, yeah, and it's not just her that gets great lines. There's also that bit with K-9 when Andred's worried about something they're doing is going to blow up part of the school, and K-9's just like, we'll give them a day off, blow it. And it's nice to have K-9 get a funny and badass line like that. And then there's also with the Doctor and Barusa, the bit where Barusa's smugly like, well, you should remember your training in detachment. And Tom just so bluntly and so well delivered has that line about, I'd rather care. It's, yeah, it's a story that's filled with some great lines. And there's also another one for Tom in that bit where Andred's like, oh, you've got the access to the greatest source of knowledge in the universe. And he's just like, well, I do talk to myself. And yeah, it's such a brilliant story. So many great bits like that. And Leela promising to try not to kill anyone. It's, yeah, I love it. And there's the only fault I could really find when I was rewatching it is, it goes way downhill when the Sontarans arrive. Like you said in your stuff about the audios, the Vardans, like now that we've got this hindsight of all these audios with them, they come across a lot stronger. And particularly if you watch like I did with the enhanced special effects, they really work well. Whereas the Sontarans get there and they're just really not very well acted. The costumes aren't as good as they used to be. It's just all a bit rubbish. And so it almost feels like it would have been a better story if they'd just said, you know, maybe get rid of that ending and just leave it at the Vardans were the big threat, maybe sell them a bit more. But even with the going downhill in the last couple of episodes, it's still such a brilliant story and just so many great moments. And yeah, as you said, the cliffhanger in particular for episode 4, though, before the Sontarans, we actually, you know, see them not executed so well. The cliffhanger on its own, that must have been an amazing one back in the day, particularly if you didn't know the story was a 6-parter, just suddenly to get that. So, yeah, I love this one. It's such an underrated one, I find.
I think it's also, you know, you mentioned K-9 having some good lines. I think it's actually K-9's first great story. Like, this is the one where we really do see the K-9 that we're going to get moving forward. Except it's not, obviously, because this K-9 stays behind and we get Mark II moving forward. But I think K-9 as a character really actually sort of comes into his own in this one. And there are some great moments. And yeah, I genuinely like the fact that K-9 functions so well in this one. The Vardans, you know, I forgot to mention this before. The Vardans are really, really helped by the special effects that came in on the DVD, I think, the new CGI effects, just sort of making them something that's not tinfoil improves them. Like, what's on the DVD is no big improvement whatsoever, really. They're just not tinfoil anymore, and that's a step up on its own. Yeah, a lot to enjoy in this one, and it really does do a good job of building on the Deadly Assassin, building on what we learnt about Time Lord society and how it functions. It is a direct sequel, really, to Deadly Assassin. You know, Deadly Assassin ends with no president on Gallifrey and the Doctor is the only candidate. So I like the idea that thread's kind of picked up here. And we're going to have a few examples of sort of the idea of the Doctor being president of the Time Lords, on and off moving forward now. But this is the only time we really actually see it. This is the only time it gets done. And of course, he's out of character for the majority of it because he's pretending to be a baddie. But yeah, what a very fun story and a very strong end to a season. It's a flawed end to a flawed season, but it is a strong end to the season as well. And I think we do pick up with 16. I think 16 is a definite improvement on 15, purely because there's no underworld. There is nothing that bad. There is stuff that's not great, but there's nothing CGI caves bad. But yeah, it's been a good series. I've enjoyed discussing it as ever, and it's good to be back doing season by season as well. As I said at the beginning, we've had a little break, so it's good to be here again. So that is all we have time for, so I will say a big thank you to Greg.
Thank you, goodbye, and I'm looking forward to hunting for the key to time.
It's going to be great to get to the key to time. Thank you and goodbye to Jimmy as well.
Thanks, it's great to be back.
And we will be back for more podcasting very soon. Goodbye now.